Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, you're listening to The Future of Media Explained with me, Press Gazette Editor-in-Chief Dominic Ponsford. I'm being joined by reporter Bron Maher. And this week, we're learning all about how to make news work on YouTube. Hi, Bron. Good to see you.
Hi, Dom. Nice to see you. I'm coming to you today from underneath a blanket in my bedroom.
I can see that. I assume it's for the acoustic benefits, not because of an attack of agoraphobia.
No, I'm pleased to say I remain outgoing and active.
Oh, fantastic. So look, listen, this week we've got a podcast that speaks to a few of the big themes this year. Video, which is very big. YouTube, that's very big. Reaching the youth, that's very big. And we're speaking to a brand, a news brand, that's managing to do all these things and make a kind of go of it, make a business of it. What are they called, Bron?
They're called TLDR News, Dom. And for those who have not been paying as much attention online for a while, TLDR is a slang, I suppose, or an acronym for too long didn't read. And you usually use it to basically, you'll say like TLDR and then summarize whatever the big long thing that you just sent in a group chat was.
Okay, so we're going to get into that. Well worth everyone's while listening to. But before we do that, I just need to read out a message or give a mention to our sponsor for this week's episode, which is the podcast show London 2024. Why should we go to the podcast show in London 2024, Bron, you ask me? Let me tell you why. It's the biggest international festival for the business of podcasting. It brings together thousands from the global podcast community under one roof at the Business Design Centre in Islington on the 22nd and 23rd of May. You can get hundreds of hours of industry insight from hundreds of global players and award-winning creatives. In the evening, the podcast show live represents a week-long festival lineup of live podcasts from the 20th to the 26th of May. It's all going on at the podcast show in London. So my key point to convey is this. It's the biggest event for the global podcast industry. Top-tier bands, award-winning creators, huge names. You can book your passes now at thepodcastshowlondon.com. That's thepodcastshowlondon.com. And Press Gazette is a media and content partner for the show, so we'll be there as well. We'd like to see you there. So, on to the meat of the podcast. TLDR News. So, everyone seems to be doing lots on YouTube at the moment. Mail Online are going very big on YouTube. The Independent are big on YouTube. Lots of publishers are doing it because obviously it's a way to make money. YouTube, if you're on YouTube, you get a share of the ad revenue. I think it's 55%, might even be more publishers. So you get a slice of the action. And I mean, I've always assumed that the numbers were so that you needed to get millions and millions of people to log on. And so it never worked. But it sounds like TLDR News are making it work. Is that right?
Yeah, so they're an interesting one. They came to my attention because their founder and CEO and 100% owner still, Jack Kelly, was a panelist at the launch for an FT Strategies report into the next generation of news. And he was a really interesting speaker, not least because, you know, he was speaking about TLDR News, which is this 11-person news outlet that lives entirely on YouTube and is profitable. And the oldest person there is 31, which is kind of nuts. Like when so many news publishers are really struggling right now, just to see such a young outlet purely living off one of the platforms profitably was, well, I immediately went up afterwards and was like, hi, can I talk to you more about this? Yeah.
We must hear how they're doing it, because, and then we can all replicate them. Because they're not only making it work, making money out of it, but they're also sort of targeting a slightly younger audience as well, which is another kind of bugbear for many publishers, is the fact that you know, younger people, they struggle to engage with them. And obviously the problem with that is that they don't go to publisher websites, but they do spend a lot of time on YouTube. So, you know, the argument is that, well, you need to go where they are rather than get them to come over to your house. You need to go around to their house.
It certainly is. And he does voice a bit of a concern about, you know, platform shifts and all that kind of stuff. But they have a reasonably loyal audience, like people who genuinely keep coming back to them. And so they've managed to kind of cultivate that kind of direct relationship that previously newspapers used to have with their readers, or previously people used to have through homepages on news sites.
Brilliant. Well, look, listen, Bron, lead us into the interview. Who are we speaking to?
We are speaking to Jack Kelly, the CEO of TLDR News, at their studios in Blackfriars.
So, first off, Jack Kelly, congratulations on being the youngest person we have interviewed on the podcast, I believe. For anyone who's not already familiar with TLDR News, how would you describe your journalism?
So we make generally kind of short, relatively short form explainer videos, not like TikTok, Instagram Reels level of short, but kind of 8 to 10 minute explainer videos that dive into a really specific topic from anywhere around the world, really. We cover UK news, obviously, but we also cover geopolitics and global elections and conflicts and everything else. And the concept of our videos is that all of our content is entirely impartial and neutral. And what we're trying to do is give young people, especially, the background and the knowledge they need on these specific topics so that they can then form their own opinions and arrive at parents' house or work or wherever they want to be and sound informed. We provide them with the context that allows them to do that.
And can you tell me a bit about the origins of the outlet? Like, how did you come into being in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. I started in 2017. It was the day that Theresa May called the general election. I'd wanted to do something in journalism and kind of on YouTube for a while. And I saw that and I thought, this is maybe the moment. This is like a sudden, interesting thing. It was that day I suddenly just made my first video. I came up with the branding, everything in one evening. I was at university at the time. And then from there, we kind of slowly grew over a couple of years, like really slowly. The first 2 years, we gained like 1,000 YouTube subscribers, which felt like a lot at the time. It was enough to earn monetization on YouTube, which was a big deal. And it was around a kind of year or so later in 2018 that a couple of people reached out to me for the first time from the audience, those being a guy called Zach and a guy called Ben. And they've offered to volunteer some of their time. They were both students as well at the time, and they wanted to help with the kind of writing of videos. And they kind of came on board and we slowly grew with their help to the point that in 2020, we hired our first full-time editor, Alex. And then since then, we've gone from one full-time team member to 11 now. And in fact, Zach and Ben are both still working for us. Zach is our editor-in-chief and Ben runs our UK coverage. So it's really fortunate that two random people on Facebook happened to message me and both were good enough that they're still sat next door.
And like, what's the age spread here? Like, how old are the people working at TLDR?
The youngest person, I believe, is 22, and the oldest person is 31, generally skewing slightly younger. I'm 27, and I think I'm in the upper end. I think most people are roughly 25-ish.
Mm-hmm. Do you do much original reporting?
No, not a whole lot, honestly. The kind of coverage we're doing is seeking to take big events that have already happened and condense them and explain them in a neutral and kind of approachable way, especially for a younger age group. So just because of the economics of that and just because of the kind of content people expect from us, we don't tend to do all that much original reporting.
You know, as you would hope, I have watched a few TLDR videos. And something that kind of jumped out to me was, for all that they break down what might otherwise be kind of intimidating concepts and jargon, They are still pretty like straight, classically newsy, yeah, like 8 minutes, which we're kind of often told that younger and social media using consumers are kind of allergic to that style of news. So why does it work for you?
I think that is a good point. I think our content, if you haven't seen it before and you hear me talk about it or someone else talk about it, I think you might assume that it's kind of more fun than it is.
Yes, like, that is what I was thinking.
So you said it's slightly more kind than I did. But I think you'd expect it to be kind of really YouTube, really kind of energetic and sound effects and jokes. And it's not really that. I think the style of video is a little bit more natively YouTube. I think the way that we present, the room we're in, the set, the tone of voice, I think all of those things are more YouTube than they are like News at 10. But equally, we are definitely inspired by the more traditional news outlets in that way. And I think kind of why it works is just because there is such a variety of audience. I think there's definitely wisdom to the idea that younger generations expect different things from their news and do want different things. But equally, to pretend that an entire 10-year generation all want the same thing from their news is clearly inaccurate. And I think there's definitely a more generalist audience that maybe we don't perfectly appeal to. We definitely do appeal to kind of the more young economist FT reader type. They've maybe not made it to those outlets yet. They're maybe still too intimidating, but we're leaning towards those kind of very curious, quite analytical people. And I think there's a definite market for that. I don't think it's necessarily the primary market. I'm not sure our audience is representative of what the entire young news consumer wants, but there's definitely a whole bunch of people that do want a more approachable, more friendly, more authentic feeling kind of traditional almost news outlet.
I wonder if you're blowing some listeners' minds being like, there are separate audiences within young consumers. What are you talking about?
I think any generation, I was about to say, looking kind of older people looking at younger people, but I think equally the other way around. Obviously, the generational labels are useful to some regard. I mean, I was part of a report done by the FT recently on younger news consumers that regularly groups them together. And while that report is careful to point out there are differences and whatever else, I think just the framing sometimes of like, here is what Gen Z wants, is just kind of like, it leads to inaccuracies almost by default, because there is no one thing Gen Z wants, because Gen Z isn't a person, it's millions of people.
And how do your audiences tend to find you? Do you get like recommended through YouTube's algorithm? Like, is it like a word of mouth type deal?
So for example, our TLDR Global YouTube channel, which is one of our bigger ones, focuses on geopolitics, as the name kind of suggests. 42% of the viewers came from browse features. So that's things like the YouTube homepage, that's suggested videos. So a huge proportion of our views come from those. In fact, if you look at the data YouTube provides, our videos were surfaced 42.3 million times in the last 28 days. Of that, 5.3% of people click through. That's our click-through rate, which leads to about 2.3 million views from impressions on that channel specifically. Obviously, that's only from browse features. If you're talking about the whole network, you're talking probably easily in excess of 100 million every month. So yeah, 42% come from there. 30% come from the shorts feed. So that's kind of similar, obviously. That's when the videos are presented when you're scrolling through vertical video. 13% are suggested videos. So that's when we're placed alongside other similar videos. If you look at those suggested videos, if you zoom in a bit more deeply in the YouTube backend, you'll find that a lot of the time those suggested videos are alongside our own content. YouTube's pretty good at that, that when they work out what your audience likes and which type of your own videos your audience likes, it then suggests that more. And then about 4% comes from search. Search is a surprisingly small segment. I think you might assume like people are actively looking for these things, especially for news, which is like one of those things where often consumers are expected to go out and find it, especially traditionally. A very small proportion of our audience is. And I think if you drill down into those numbers, about half of that 4% are actively just Googling for TLDR news. They're not coming across us because they've searched Israel-Gaza conflict or whatever. They're searching for us.
Now, I imagine that the various media insiders who are listening to this podcast are sitting at home and they're like, maybe in the car, on the tube, whatever. And they're like, well, this is all very well, but how does it pay? How are you making money? Are you making money? How does this work commercially? What would you say to those questions?
All of those questions at once.
Well, let's start with just, first off, you know, obviously YouTube will split some of the revenue for some creators.
Yes.
Shovel that your way. Is that what this is all built on, or is it more sponsorships? What are your bread and butter in terms of making money?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a mix. YouTube ad revenue, so those are the pre-roll and mid-roll ads that are algorithmically and kind of sold on an auction basis at the front of videos. Those do make up about 40% of our total revenue across the board. Then about a similar amount, 40%-ish too, comes from sponsorship within videos. The key difference there being the AdSense, the programmatic ads are provided by YouTube. We do nothing for those. And they're just a case of, it's an advert. It's right. A separate unit. The sponsorships are baked into the video and they are hosted by whoever is hosting the video. So that may be me, that may be Ben, Georgina, Nadia. One of our hosts will actively say, this video is brought to you by X company. And that's something that they pay for, they pay directly for. And that is something that we manage alongside our agent, Nebula. And they help us find those sponsors. The remaining 20 is kind of a mix. We get paid to speak at and attend events. We get paid for merchandise projects we do. Like we recently released a print newspaper just because we thought it would be silly. And things like that, kind of donations. There's kind of a mixture of small things besides that. But yeah, YouTube ad revenue is a pretty large chunk of our total money.
On the newspaper, we chatted a bit about this before we began recording. Mm. So you made money on this newspaper print run, right? How did that work?
Too Long is a one-off physical newspaper we made that dives into everything that happened last year throughout 2023 and everything that we expect to happen this year. And the idea was that it was kind of just a bit of silly fun. We found out it was relatively cheap to do a few thousand print run. Mm-hmm. So we thought, how hard can it be? People do it every day. I mean, they're professionals, no insult to the listeners. But we kind of thought, if we have 3 months to put together a newspaper and we've got a bunch of people that are used to writing content really quickly and to a high standard, it can't be that hard. Turns out it was a bit harder than we thought, admittedly. But even still, yeah, we put together, I think it's a 32-page, really high-quality newspaper that we then sold to our audience as like a end-of-year Christmas gift kind of vibe. I think we sold about 7,000 or 8,000 copies in the end, which is way higher than our initial projections. Also meant a lot more envelope stuffing than we expected, but that is an issue that I'll leave to the team next door. I obviously took part, but I'll leave to them to complain about. But yeah, no, we made money from it. It was relatively cheap to put together. And yeah, we sold 7,000 or 8,000 copies for about between £8 and £10 each, depending on when you bought them in the cycle. So we made in excess of £50,000 from that, which isn't like the most money in the world, sure, but it easily pays for like one of our journalists for the entire year.
Right.
So you can easily say that if we were to do this annually, that is actively supporting at least one staff member, which is amazing and like a really cool, interesting, silly way of us kind of going backwards. We've conquered new media. So we jokingly said, we're going back and we're getting old media too.
While I have you giving away numbers, can you tell us anything about your revenues? And so I encountered you first because you were speaking at the event to launch the FT Strategies report. And you said that TLDR News is in profit, which is great, and not that many media businesses can necessarily confidently say the same right now. So how good is business right now?
It's pretty good. I think the last year has been a little tougher for a number of like really specific business reasons. It's kind of the last year has been a little tough, but that's not an ongoing trend. That's just like a number of circumstances added up to make that the case. But generally, the business model is pretty sound. We've never taken investment externally. I still own 100% of the company. All of our money has just been reinvested. We're fortunate enough that we have a relatively large amount of money just in the bank. That means we can make decisions with some comfort that almost, not that nothing could go wrong, but we have a certain amount of buffer there intentionally, which is really useful. Generally, though, yeah, we're definitely making a profit on almost every video we make. Our total advertising revenue from 2023 was £333,000 from YouTube. And then about the same, I'm not sure I'm allowed to give a specific number on sponsorships, but about the same, slightly more from sponsorships.
Yeah.
Then when you add everything else in, you're looking at a total revenue of just under a million, probably £750,000 a year. And I mean, it's obviously not cheap to hire kind of 11 people. Mm-hmm. This office space is ludicrously expensive. If our landlords are listening, I don't mind them knowing that. But it obviously is expensive. Our kind of monthly operating cost is kind of fairly high, considering we try and make sure that we do everything properly. Mm. We pay our team kind of, I would argue, more than the industry rate. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they would agree, but I hope they would. And I think the stats suggest that I'm right. But yeah, we certainly try and do everything properly, and we certainly could be a lot lazier with it. Mm-hmm. I think, not to name names, but there's certainly kind of social news or like that kind of outlets mm-hmm. that do really lazy content, just kind of clipping stuff, uploading stuff, reusing stuff. We try and make sure all of our content is really high value and right. really high production and like useful. Mm-hmm. And that obviously comes with costs too. But fortunately, the revenue we're able to drive from YouTube, from sponsorships, more than offsets that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're definitely profitable, at least in the aggregate.
Hi, I'm Anoush, and I host the New Statesman podcast. Twice a week, we get under the skin of Westminster to help understand what's going on and what's going to happen next. We interview politicians, policymakers, and people on the front line to get you the full story behind the headlines. Plus, hear from our award-winning editorial team, including political editor Andrew Marr, to get to the bottom of what on earth is happening. Listen to the New Statesman podcast. You can subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
On Shorts, there's been reporting suggesting that YouTube's been pushing its creators towards Shorts at the moment because, mm-hmm. you know, competes with Instagram and TikTok, etc. Most of the videos I've seen for TLDR News, like, you know, 8-10 minutes. Mm-hmm. How does that work? You know, explainer journalism recut for a definitionally shorter form video.
Yeah, it's definitely true that YouTube are actively pushing creators towards Shorts, both from their messaging towards us. We're being told that that is a good strategy. We're being given support in that way. So that's definitely something YouTube is pushing towards. As you say, it makes perfect sense from their perspective. There is a move towards vertical scrolling video on TikTok and on Instagram. So it makes perfect sense they want that. Equally, I mean, I'll answer your question in a second. Equally, I would say that there is a lot of data suggesting that the audience is kind of diverging. It's not just moving towards short form. There's also been a massive uptick lately in really long form videos. You're talking like over an hour, and also specifically in living room viewing on YouTube. There's been a massive uptick in the number of people who are sitting down and watching kind of more documentary style, TV style videos. So I think that is maybe a slight pushback on the narrative that Gen Z audiences and younger audiences don't have the attention span. They only want vertical scrolling. There definitely is a space for really long form video. I mean, some of the creators on Nebula and also just ones we're friends with are making 2-3 hour long videos and seeing the retention very strong throughout. So it kind of goes both ways. While to be honest, the middle ground, the kind of medium length video we primarily make, also is performing really well right now. So it's quite useful that there's these different spaces and different platforms. When it comes to the content we make, you're right. Our videos don't naturally translate to short form. We've talked about it a lot because some of the early advice from YouTube was to take clips out of existing videos, find the moments that people really liked, and then clip that and make it a short. And for some creators, that works really well. If you're a big entertainment comedy kind of creator, just clip the funny moments, the best jokes, the explosions, and that's a short. And that does work. And there's a whole bunch of creators that do that. But for us, it kind of doesn't work. The most interesting part of one of our videos is nearly always near the end, because that's what we've been building towards. We've been providing the context, and then we explain the interesting thing. But the problem is that you need all the context. So if we clip out the really interesting bit, you've got something kind of meaningless. Equally, if we clip out the bit that makes the most sense, that will be the first minute, because that is the context. That's the on-ramp. But the problem is that isn't interesting. That's just a bit of history about a country, and then we get on to the interesting part. So for us, that doesn't work. And we tried to reformat our content into the kind of 1 minute vertical space and make a new version of our videos, kind of still breaking news, still news stories, but quicker. And it just didn't work. So I think the main learning we have is that just repurposing your content doesn't necessarily work, especially in news. Equally, trying to squash your content into a really small format also doesn't necessarily work. For us, what we found is that we're making entirely different content on Shorts. We currently run a number of series where we look at things like conflicts around the world that you might have missed, the weirdest borders around the world, interesting political systems and why they work. These are kind of very different from the primary videos we'd make. We probably would never do a video just explaining a country's weird constitution or whatever. Maybe we would if it was interesting enough. But we found that by having these themes and these series, we can put together kind of 10 to 12 shorts relatively easily. It's a bunch of work, not to disregard what Jeremy does really well with our short stuff. But because we're batching it and because we're doing it in themes, we can produce a series in one go and then kind of drop it day by day on a channel. So we found that that kind of more evergreen content performs better, the things that aren't super contemporary and super newsworthy. I think there have been creators and news agencies that have made the contemporary breaking news work, but especially on YouTube, you regularly see the first 7 days, you will get a big spike in viewership right at the beginning from your existing subscribers. People have got the notifications turned on. They'll watch it in the first day or so. Then it will flatten out for the next 7 days, and then the algorithm will pick it up again about a week later. And that's when either it takes off or it kind of bumps a bit and then plateaus again. And the problem with that, obviously, is if you're doing a breaking news story, 7 days when it gets picked up by the algorithm just is way too long.
Interesting. So I should ask, you know, there's so much of the news industry right now, especially kind of legacy publishers, are kind of trying to keep cool heads amid what I'm going to describe as a slew of troubling problems. For example, platform shift, the rise of generative AI. And are any of those issues affecting you, or are there any big structural commercial changes that are worrying you and TLDR News at the moment?
I think probably our most existential risk would be platform shift. We are very focused on YouTube, and we certainly could work to diversify the platforms we work on. The issue kind of is just budget constraints, that we are profitable, we earn enough money, we're self-sustaining. But if you were to suddenly drive a massive push towards another platform, that would then become more challenging. That would fairly quickly need to become profitable to justify its existence. So we are fairly focused on YouTube, partly because we have to be, because not being focused on YouTube would be fairly expensive. Also, we are just quite confident in YouTube as a platform, that it's sustained for a long time. It isn't really a social media platform in the same way that they go through cycles. It is more of a Netflix or a streamer than it is anything else. So we're relatively confident, and we kind of think to some extent that if YouTube were to fall over overnight, that would be such a catastrophic issue for us anyway, that we probably, even if we had diversified, we'd be kind of screwed regardless. So we've kind of formed the calculus there that doubling down on YouTube is risky for sure, but the risk is low enough that balancing and kind of countering for that would be too complicated and not worth it. So that's probably the biggest risk, is some kind of platform shift. The advantage we have is that we're already big on the platform that other publishers want to be big on.
Right.
The fact that we started on YouTube, we're not tackling the shift from print or native websites or any of these other things. We are on the place where people are. I think it's obviously more of a threat and more of a concern if your business model relies on expensive subscriptions and things like that to sustain the kind of production, the talent, the overheads. We're fortunate that we're lean enough that, I mean, it's not a huge amount of money, but we are able to easily sustain all of the team. So I think we're fortunate in that regard. I think platform shift is almost works in our favor, even though it is a slight risk. When it comes to things like generative AI, I think it is a bit of a concern. I think it's more of a concern to the industry at large rather than us specifically. But I think we have been working hard to build a direct relationship with our audience. And I think in the future, I'm sure you could have an AI model that was sophisticated enough that it could act authentically enough as a human that you could then build a relationship with an audience. But I think, one, we're a way away from that. And two, we're pre-established personalities at this point. I think if you were just a news brand that didn't have human-facing elements, I think it then gets a lot harder. If you are a news brand that is just a logo, just a brand, it doesn't have a human face, a human thing that someone connects to, I think then it's far easier to replace because someone else can make a generatively created AI logo and they can pump out content and it's suddenly harder to tell the difference. For us and for other news companies that do have forward-facing journalists that do actively build that relationship, especially on social, there's a bunch of news agencies that do have journalists that are recognizable, but are they journalists you feel a personal connection to? Kind of if you think about, I mean, for obvious reasons, the constraints around the BBC, but you think about a lot of their personalities, people know them. They're hugely famous, some of the most famous journalists in the country. But how many of those people do you feel a strong personal affinity to? Maybe some of them, and maybe some people specifically do, especially kind of generations that do watch more TV news than I might do. But I think the audience we've built, our audience know us. They know about our lives. They can interact with us on Twitter. We respond to their complaints in videos. We feel very human. And I think the risk of Gen AI is much more threatening if you as an institution don't feel human, because it's the humanness that's hard to kind of replicate. I think the advantage we have is that we have the least replicatable thing. We have human connection. And I would be more concerned for news brands that don't.
Now, I'm kind of thinking, you know, there are probably some people listening at legacy publications who are who are kind of thinking like, well, why isn't my YouTube channel doing that? I mean, a lot of publishers are seeing a lot of YouTube growth at the moment, but, you know, there are some who are maybe taking their first faltering steps onto the platform. And maybe they're wondering, like, why am I not getting quite as much engagement? Why is my team not growing quite this fast? What kind of advice would you give to them?
I think the most obvious difference is the way that we approach the platform. There's various ways that I think mainstream and like traditional news outlets do YouTube wrong, and it's kind of hard to diagnose generally because there's so many different things. And I'm not saying we do everything perfectly by any means, like we're not ideal. There's definitely things we do wrong as well. The most obvious one though is just how you treat the platform. A lot of news publishers don't treat the platform as a creator would. You're looking at some of these publications that are posting hundreds of videos a day on the same channel. And you're right, there'll definitely be some you can pull out. When you sort by their most viewed videos, there'll be some in there that have millions. Like they'll have some really good videos, no doubt. But there's also thousands of videos that are getting basically no views.
Yeah.
And that isn't even necessarily an issue from an algorithmic perspective. YouTube regularly tells us that they take each video on its own, and while they do look at audience trends and how regularly your audience engages, each individual video is treated separately. So if you have a bunch of videos that do badly, it shouldn't mean your next one will do too, unless the audience just lose interest kind of on a human level rather than an algorithmic one. But the issue is the kind of human response there. The algorithm might not be punishing you for posting all those videos, but if you're one of these publications that is posting hundreds and hundreds of videos, there's no one person that's actually watching that. That's not how YouTube works. That's not what the platform is. The platform works best when you're building a curated selection of videos and building a connection with an audience. And I think when you look at YouTube channels that do well from big news brands, they do tend to be ones that do things more like we do. We still post 3 videos at least most days, but those 3 videos are published across a number of different channels. Each of our channels normally receives about 4 videos a week. And that is a much more manageable quantity of content to watch. And it means that when we post a video, our audience have that connection, they have that trust, that they know they're a fan of the TLDR EU channel. So they know that even if the topic maybe isn't the exact thing they're most interested in, they trust there's something interesting there because we built that connection. If you're just putting a fire hose of content out there, the audience has to be more selective. Also, it's just not how YouTube works as a platform. I think the advice is to look at creators, see how they're publishing videos, and you will never find a creator that is posting hundreds of videos a day, obviously, because that's not possible. But even 2, 3, 4 videos a day is way more than the vast, vast majority of creators publish, even ones with resources that would allow them to post that much content if they wanted to. And I think that lack of understanding of the native platform does make it really difficult. And it's not even about just the quantity they're publishing. It's also just about the tone. it's really easy and useful if you're a TV news channel to just clip bits of your show and put them on YouTube. Super easy. You've already paid for it. It already exists. The problem is that really what your audience on YouTube wants? As we referenced earlier, a lot of our content does feel kind of straight down the line serious. It does kind of have a vibe of TV news to it a bit. But the production and the way that we curate and the way that we talk to our audience is authentically and natively YouTube, which no matter how well scripted the content is, if it's a clip from the 10 o'clock news, if it's a clip from whatever, if it's a clip of someone stood outside a building, very formal in a suit, that just never really has the vibe of YouTube. Mm-hmm. And that isn't perfectly important. In a really big moment, you obviously see through data that audiences often turn back to the traditional. They want those authoritative voices.
Right.
But day to day, they kind of want a trusted friend. They want someone out there that is a connection that feels like a peer almost, that can select the news that matters to them and present it in a way that makes sense. And I think in the FT report we mentioned earlier, that is one thing that was regularly mentioned by the participants in that study, was that they look to other people to curate their news and to bring news to their attention. They're looking for filters. They're looking for people in their lives who can highlight what matters. And I think news organizations have the potential to be that to some extent. But I think we do that. We are able to select topics that are important, and we're able to surface those and explain them in a way like a friend would. And I think that's a real value that mainstream outlets often miss. Mm-hmm. And I think actually the way to solve that, you can have a master YouTube channel that still covers everything. But I think developing sub-brands specifically with journalists is a really good way of allowing that curation and that connection with the journalist. I think it's the Wall Street Journal have started doing this in the US. They're allowing some of their journalists to begin creating their own YouTube videos on their own channels. And I believe, or at least, I don't know the details, but I would imagine the Wall Street Journal still maintains the right to all that content.
Right.
I imagine they're being paid as a journalist, not as a creator.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're paid a cut of ad rev. I'm not totally sure. But it's a really interesting way of doing it, so that the audience can build a relationship with the creators and the journalists rather than with a big institution.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of kind of older journalists maybe listening might be thinking, oh, I mean, it's a great idea to let them go off and, you know, be good at social media, but like, what if I have brand standards to maintain?
Yeah.
What if I have like the strictness of the Wall Street Journal, the impartiality of the BBC to obtain? Like,
absolutely.
What do I do if those journalists are going out there and be maybe developing slightly too political parasocial relationships with their audiences?
That's a real concern. And it's something we're fortunate that we don't have to worry about quite so much. Obviously, we're trying to be neutral, so the kind of political side is a concern still. But that is what allows us to do things like sponsorships and brand deals, because we are independent and we are able to authentically say, this is how we're paid. We don't have a license fee or whatever else. We don't have like big billionaire owners. So I think there's some more understanding there. So I understand we've got an advantage. But I think Shelby Holiday from the Wall Street Journal, her YouTube channel is really good and is a good balance between stuff that would already appear on the Wall Street Journal's YouTube channel probably. They have a relatively good YouTube presence anyway, but they've managed to carve out her stuff and build an identity there in a way that another major outlet might have a certain brand or a certain series appearing alongside the 300 other terrible clips right. they're publishing that day. Breaking that out and building a more YouTube-centric approach is really important. Now, obviously that's expensive and obviously that's difficult, but I think if you're really keen to play the game, you have to actually play the game. And that is by being native to whichever platform you're working on, YouTube or otherwise.
Well, Jack Kelly from TLDR News, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Thanks for that, Bron. It's nice to have something positive to report. We always like to have positive things on Press Gazette, but there's been a fair bit of gloom around the industry here and there the last few months. So, you know, it's good to hear about some people who are making it work. Albeit, I guess, if Google did something awful to the algorithm or suddenly changed how much revenue it gives you, I suppose that would be a worry for them. But it hasn't happened yet, and we have to hope that Google's kind of keen to encourage this sort of thing on its platform.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that they're kind of cognizant of that they speak of it in terms of kind of a risk calculation, that they're like, well, what makes sense for us is to stay on here.
Yeah, I think Google's probably sensible enough to realize that explainer journalism is something to be encouraged and a nice thing to have on YouTube, as well as all the other interesting content on there.
Yeah, and it sounds like Google is engaging quite directly with them. I mean, I'm sure they're just kind of engaging with them in the same capacity that they would with any professional content creation business on their platform. But nonetheless, it's good that they're getting that kind of support.
So there's a lot of chat amongst publishers at the moment about doing more on video. In fact, when I spoke to Christian Broughton, at the who's the CEO of The Independent recently, he said that the shift towards them being a video production company is going to be as profound as the shift was 7 years ago when they went from publishing a print newspaper to being just a website. And they're not alone in that. So what do you think publishers can learn from the TLDR news approach as they try and embrace video and try and get that audience and get some of that ad revenue?
I think there are two, maybe three things that really stood out to me in the podcast. For one thing, Kelly makes a point that there are more than one audience within younger ages, shall I say. Like, yes, okay, there might be a broad preference for short-form video, let's say, for people between ages 18 and 24. But, you know, some of those people are going to be, I don't know, just like not news engagers in the first place, whereas some of those people are going to be, you know, ultimately, I don't know, they're going to end up working hedge funds or in government or as civil servants or, you know, just down the local council. And these are people who are like interested and plugged into what's going on, and they still want information, but they might not want it behind a paywall on The Economist's website, and they might not want it in a newspaper or having to watch an hour-long documentary. They want it in some format that is more suited to their needs and their preferences. And so you can still make proper, you know, what we might call more traditional journalism, but kind of repurposed for these platforms. The second thing that really stood out to me was his point about it maybe not working so well to just churn out tons of videos all the time. Like, I get it, it makes sense that news publishers would do that because, you know, they're professional publishers. They have this machine to put out loads of content. And maybe after years of feeding the huge content desire in the kind of traffic-led era of the last decade, maybe publishers are still too used to just putting out tons and tons of content. Whereas what's really going to work better, maybe, if TLDR's model is kind of the right one, is high engagement. A smaller number of things that are really thought through, made for the platform, and that build up a following among a particular audience. And then the one that might get a bit more, let's say, pushback from some journalists is the notion of kind of freeing up individual journalists to be your personalities, who are kind of like developing almost parasocial relationships potentially with their audiences, which, if you're not familiar with a parasocial relationship, basically it's just like, I don't know, developing a bit of a direct relationship with someone you have on the other side of a screen, interacting with them on Twitter, in the comment sections, you know, that kind of stuff. But it does seem to work for upping interest and engagement with audiences.
Well, traditional broadcasters have been alive to that forever, haven't they? So the news anchors have always cultivated that thing where they're sort of like a trusted person in the corner of the living room who you feel like you know.
And actually, I do encourage you to go and just watch some TLDR stuff, because it really isn't... I think if you've ever seen clips from, like, I don't know, News Daddy on TikTok or something, like, a lot of what we might associate with video youth news right now is like quick cuts, big personalities, yada yada. Whereas TLDR is like, it's almost kind of an anchor-led format. Like, someone sits behind a desk and talks you through these big concepts. It's almost similar to kind of Ross Atkins stuff on BBC. But it really does seem to have worked. Like, it's so similar to what BBC, ITN do regularly, but just slightly change of an emphasis, slight change of tone for a recut for YouTube.
Sounds surprisingly sensible. Brilliant. Thank you, Bron. You've been listening to The Future of Media Explained with me, Press Gazette Editor-in-Chief, Dominic Ponsford, reporter Bron Maher. And Bron, remind me who we were speaking to at TLDR News.
We were talking to Jack Kelly.
We were produced by Suze Cooper. And before I go, I'm just going to give one last plug to our sponsor, the podcast show London. We'll be there. It's at the Business Design Centre, Islington, on the 22nd, 23rd of May. Book your place at thepodcastshowlondon.com. Thanks very much for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.